It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. You can grill brats and burgers and other meats, but we're not stopping there. Coming up on Food Friday, we'll talk about how to grill vegetables, fruits, bread, even dessert. First, when you think of the word endowment, you might think of multi-million dollar funds for a big-name university. Well, an endowment called the Gresham Scholarship Fund is making headlines for reaching the milestone of $1 million, and it's for graduating high school seniors in this village of less than 1,000 people. We're talking about a community that came together to make college more accessible for kids who grow up there. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you live in Gresham or another community that has a college scholarship fund? Did a scholarship fund help you or your kids afford higher education? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Bob Klopke started the Gresham Scholarship Fund. He was the principal of Gresham High School for 14 years, and he joins us now. Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
The scholarship fund hit the million-dollar mark last year, but this has been 20 years in the making. Where did the idea come for this?
Well, quite honestly, it's a little bit of a copycat situation. I was part of a school district called Shawano Gresham 20 years ago, and in Shawano, they started up a Dollars for Scholars program, and it seemed to be going well, and I envied them, but I also had three daughters in my school, and being a small town, I didn't want it to look as though I was trying to find a way to finance my own kids' education. So
sure.
I waited a bit, and when the last one graduated, then I started sending out some letters to people in the community to see if we could get together and get something going. And it all fell into place little by little. Got lucky that way, I guess. But the community has been a strong supporter. I know your intro said that we were less than 1,000. We're actually less than 600 in the village of Gresham. And, of course, we include some of the surrounding area as well. And,
sure.
And our graduates over the years have been good supporters of this program. So,
how does the endowment work? Who's eligible for these scholarships?
Well, we've set up criteria and a simple application. It's really only about one page long, although nowadays, the last few years anyway, it's been electronic, and so the students fill it out online for us, but it probably takes them 15, 20 minutes to fill it out. One of our board members likes to remind them that, you know, you can take that 15 or 20 minutes, so multiply whatever the award is times 3 or 4, and that's how much money they're making per hour by getting it filled out. Right now, this year, we're awarding $3,250 per student. So if it takes them 20 minutes to fill it out, you're getting close to $10,000. And it's nice.
That's not a bad rate per hour, for sure. And this is, especially with the short form, I mean, this is eligible to a lot of people who might not have the skills or the time even to sit down and write, you know, essays for a bunch of different small scholarships or something like this. It really is accessible, right?
Correct. And we've kept it that way. We started off with the Dollars for Scholars program, and we broke off from them, and we set up our own situation here. We've got our own 501c3 designation with the IRS, and so any money that we have donated to us is tax deductible. And really the reason that we broke off was that we wanted to keep it simple. We wanted that application process to be fairly easy. We work with the Community Foundation of the Fox Valley region, and they actually evaluate the scholarship applications for us, and they take care of that so that we don't have the small town politics getting in there and somebody thinking that that somebody's getting unfair treatment or whatever. It's they're located in Appleton and they're far enough away that hopefully anything that they do in terms of judging the applications is fair and equitable.
Sure. So students have to have at least a 2.0 grade average. They're seniors. They plan to pursue post-secondary education. When you took this idea, or even now when this idea comes in front of people, how did they respond when you say, you know, we have these basic requirements. We want to make sure that these kids have some money going into college. Do you want to donate?
Right. And I guess they like the simplicity of it. They like the fairness of it. Of giving all the students, or at least a large majority of the students, should qualify. The C average is lower than what would have gone through my mind, 20 years ago, as the threshold or whatever to getting a scholarship. I always tended to think of people with high grade points, but a 2-point. Is what we've set it at, and so anything from that point and up, the only catch that I would be remiss if I didn't mention is that we expect them to continue to have at least a 2-point when they first start college, and that they maintain that as a full-time student, and that's when we pay out. So they have to complete the first semester in good standing, and they have to be enrolled for the second semester as a full-time student. And, that's about it. It's pretty simple.
That's some good motivation there. We've got Chris in Adams who wants to join our conversation. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Bad dog decided to just go off in the background.
Yeah, that happens.
Muzzle time. Anyway, I grew up in New Holstein, Wisconsin, and Dr. Harry Steenbach, who discovered vitamin D and was a biology professor at the UW, grew up on a farm near there. And he set up an endowment fund so that valedictorians from my high school get a 4-year free tuition to the UW. And then there are lots of other smaller summer things for people, and I got a music one.
Oh, cool. Chris, thank you so much for sharing that story. And what I hear and what Chris is saying is that educators care enough to do the things like what you have done, Bob, and collaborate with people and bring people together to establish endowments. If people are listening and they are thinking about starting some sort of fund for their own community, what advice would you have for them?
Well, we work pretty closely with the Community Foundation of the Fox Valley region. They're located in Appleton, and they've got a full-time person that handles their thousands of scholarships for organizations and individuals. I would suggest that would be a good place to start contacting them, and they might ask to talk to Jill Muthig. She's the lady that I work closely with. But you have to set up, your own standards, your bylaws, and so on, getting yourself set as a group and having everybody on the same page is important. Over the last 20 years, we've had things that we've had to discuss and get everybody's thinking the same way so we can proceed together.
Yeah. Bob, thank you so much for explaining how you started this and created it and where it is now. We really appreciate your time.
No problem. Thanks for calling.
Bob Klopke started the Gresham Scholarship Fund. He was the principal of Gresham High School for 14 years. Next, we'll look at college affordability broadly in Wisconsin and how President Biden's education proposals would affect the state, especially the technical college system. And you're part of this conversation. You can call 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the president's proposal to make community college free? How much did cost factor into your decision to go to college or maybe not to go to college? You can give us a call, 800-642-1234. 1234. We've got that conversation coming up next on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. You are listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking about college affordability in Wisconsin, how our state stacks up compared to other states, how President Biden's education proposals would affect the post-secondary education system here and beyond. Your calls are welcome at 800-642-1234. How did you afford college? How have student loans helped you or maybe hurt you? Help us understand. You can share your story at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Nick Hillman is an associate professor in the School of Education and directs the Student Success through Applied Research Lab at UW-Madison. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thanks for taking the time to talk with us about it. It affects a lot of people. College tuition in Wisconsin is slightly above the national average for in-state students. How does Wisconsin stack up against other states?
We're right in the middle on a lot of these metrics. You know, when we look at our public four-year universities, as you mentioned, sort of right in the middle, our technical colleges, the two-year system in the state is also right there around the middle. And when it comes to student loan debt, we're also, a little bit below the average. But I think in many metrics, right at the average or below, it doesn't mean there aren't problems or things that could improve.
Yeah, you can interpret it as the glass half full or the glass half empty. How has college affordability here changed over the years?
Well, in all states, states appropriate money to public universities, public colleges and universities. And in a lot of states, especially after the Great Recession, they've really changed that dynamic and they have not invested as much money into state appropriations that go broadly to colleges. And so as a result, colleges are looking for revenue from other places. And a big one becomes students and tuition. And so in Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin system has had a tuition freeze for several years, I believe since 2013. And so because of that, tuition has not risen quite as quickly as it has in other states. But there are also, non-tuition expenses that oftentimes matter, that are continuing to go up. And there's also, context around, the certainty of finishing college, even though tuition might be low, you still have some uncertainties about, well, can I stick around for 4 years or five or six?
Yeah. How do the issues that you bring up apply when we think about socioeconomic divides? Because it's not equal for different people.
It is not equal for different people. That's absolutely right. And in Wisconsin, at least, thinking about high school students who are graduating from high school and they're moving into college, for those who take that path, you see those disparities start right then. In fact, they start far earlier, but you can see how this tracking occurs right from high school into college, where the majority of low-income students in Wisconsin's high schools go into the technical college system, and the majority of wealthier students or the ones who do not have economic disadvantages go to the public four-year system. And that's all and well when those two systems work together. But in Wisconsin, our two systems are completely separate. They work very hard at trying to, improve these processes and improve the sort of pathways through college by coordinating. But Wisconsin has the nation's worst transfer success rate in the country. What I mean by that is the students who start in the tech college don't finish in the four-year college. That transfer function does not work in Wisconsin. And so back to your original question, low-income students transitioning out of high school are more likely to go in the tech colleges, and that's wonderful. The tech colleges are a great asset and a great resource to the state. It also is challenging because the transfer process is extremely clunky. To use a technical term, it's very clunky in Wisconsin.
And I can see where that could be really frustrating if you are achieving a two-year degree and you want to keep going and you have higher earning potential. You know, if you keep and moving on and get a four-year degree, and then the system is just too difficult and life gets in the way.
Yeah, that is what happens. And now this is a story that happens in Wisconsin, but it's also a story that happens across the country. Students start college. Let's say that they start at a technical or a two-year college. They're working on an associate's degree for the very reasons you just described. And then for whatever reason, life happens, or college is just unaffordable or just doesn't work out for them, and the student ends up leaving college with some debt, but without a degree. And when that happens, the student now, say, has $5,000 to maybe $10,000 in student loan debt, but they don't have that boost in their earnings in the labor market. Well, this is sort of the worst of both worlds, where you've got this debt hanging over into your early life course and not a job that has the same kind of payoff for it. And because of that, a lot of students who struggle the most repaying their student loans are not the ones who have super, super high debt. Certainly, there are still struggles there, but a lot of the biggest problems in student loan debt are for these students who have relatively small debt amounts. The default rate is concentrated among the students who have just $5,000 to $10,000 in debt, and it's largely because they didn't finish and now they have debt but no degree.
President Biden has proposed that students should have free access to community college. Earlier, we talked to a former high school administrator, started a community scholarship fund. What policies are most effective to try to level that playing field and make college accessible?
Well, that's a great question, and that is exactly where the policy debates are right now. The best evidence that we have comes from some community colleges in New York and Ohio, and what they essentially do is they provide ample support services for students to not just pay for college, certainly that helps, but also to block out courses so they can take classes together. They have their programs sort of mapped out for them. They get bus passes. They have resources outside of the classroom to support their development. And so, it sometimes is very expensive on the front end to provide those services, but the reward on the back end far outweighs those costs. The public benefit is there. We just have to wait for it. So the policy conversations are oftentimes now really focused on how to build capacity, how to bring the colleges that have the least resources up to some level so that they have resources to be able to really help students complete college. And I think that that's really where the policy conversations are heading. There are some specific ways to do that that I'd be happy to talk about.
Yeah, we will have to do that in the future. Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you.
Nick Hillman is an associate professor in the School of Education and directs the Student Success through Applied Research Lab at UW-Madison. The final University of Wisconsin System spring graduates will get their diplomas this weekend in a mix of online and in-person ceremonies. It caps off a year of unprecedented disruptions thanks to the pandemic and unprecedented social upheaval. Rich Kramer reports the challenges make their accomplishments even more impressive, if somewhat bittersweet.
It looked like a day-long slow-moving parade through the UW-Green Bay campus last weekend. More than 600 graduates with up to two vehicles of family and friends in tow snaked their way past a line of cheering faculty toward the covered entrance of the university's Performing Arts Center.
Graduate, come on up!
Come on down!
There, Chancellor Michael Alexander stood waiting in full regalia for students to climb out for a graduation picture with diploma in hand. In addition to her cap and gown, education major Frances Nazario wore a Puerto Rican flag stole around her neck as she rode up to the stage with her husband driving and two young children in the back seat. Nazario says finishing out her degree during the pandemic was tough, but she's resilient.
I do it for these two little guys. You know, they're my motivation. My husband, who's held down three jobs so I can go to school full time. And it's just been a blessing and a wonderful ride. It really has.
Frances Nazario, education!
For UW-Milwaukee criminal justice major Amelia Heredia, the transition to online classes in spring of 2020 felt messy. She got her bachelor's degree last weekend and is still working towards a master's. She says all the changes due to COVID made her feel disconnected.
It doesn't feel like I'm in college. It just kind of feels like I'm typing away.
As an African-American student, Heredia says she considered taking a semester off because of added stress brought by the murder of George Floyd last year.
Like, being the perfectionist I am, I just was like, I need to push through. As a first-generation student with limited finances, there is nothing to fall back on. Like, this is my road. I just have to deal with these bumps that are being handed to me.
Amber Heidenreich graduated from UW-Superior on Saturday with a double major in criminal justice and political science.
This year has just been horrible.
Heidenreich, who also played for the women's hockey team, says she felt trapped in her room while taking classes and working remotely. Still, she believes social restrictions were warranted after she contracted COVID-19 last September.
I was sick. Like, I couldn't get out of bed for a couple days.
Heidenreich says the effects lasted for months.
When hockey practice started, I could feel that I didn't have the lung capacity I normally did. And so when I would do the workouts, I genuinely felt like I would pass out. And so I'd have to, like, take breaks.
This weekend, Marie Fredrickson of Amory will walk across the stage to get her doctorate in nursing at UW-Eau Claire. It's a second career for Fredrickson, who worked in civil engineering in the Philippines before immigrating to Wisconsin in 2004. As she pushed through the spring and fall semesters with a loaner laptop from the school, she worked in a rural nursing home and hospital.
I remember a winter in break when I didn't have school. I was working 120 hours per pay period between two jobs.
Fredrickson says the work was intense and heartbreaking.
I utilized, you know, the telephone just to call their families and, you know, for them to say goodbye. I held their hands. They were not alone at their deathbed, so I know, you know, I made a difference.
UW-Stevens Point Provost Mark Summers says he's proud of everything students and employees did to make it through a challenging year. He says the pandemic took things from us as a society we won't get back.
I think we've all done our best, higher education included, to get done what we needed to get done and to make sure we're serving our stakeholders, and in this case, our students. And, you know, like I said, we're helping them to continue their educational journeys until we can get this pandemic behind us.
For UW system campuses, the heaviest COVID-related restrictions have been eased. And this fall, administrators are hoping to bring back more social and sporting events while holding at least 75% of classes in person this fall. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Here on Central Time, if you've got plans to fire up the grill this weekend, you're in the right place. What's on the menu? Maybe some burgers, brats, steaks, chops, or chicken? There's no reason you can't throw the rest of your meal on the grates, too. We're talking corn on the cob, asparagus. Hey, like avocado? Our guest says it's awesome on the grill. Grilled fruit, there are lots of different ways to make that happen, and even, believe it or not, dessert. So this week's Food Friday is a focus on these other things, not the meat that we usually turn to, but our other options for on the grill. It's about everything else, and you are part of the conversation. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Tell us what your favorite recipe is on the grill. What have you tried that is a little bit unconventional, and how do people respond to it? 800-642-1234. Ann Ziada is a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York, and she joins us now. Ann, great to have you with us.
So great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Before we get down and talk about some of these other items, we saw one of your blog posts about the importance of flirting with our food, and we have to ask, what does that mean?
So, well, flirtatious for me should be like, you know, very innocent with food. But the idea is that you kind of approach eating as this way of like, we're going to have fun. We're not going to take it too seriously. And just bring that kind of playful energy to the table.
Because some people have very specific ways to do things. And it sounds like you're telling us, try something new a little bit.
Yeah, try something new or maybe even, you know, make it special, you know. There's suggestions about like having nice plates or, you know, having mood lighting while you're eating. You know, it doesn't have to be too fancy, but just something to make it feel fun.
All right. Well, let's get to grilling. What is your favorite thing to toss on the grill?
Oh, I got it myself a grill last year during quarantine, and I just wanted to put everything on it. so it was a lot of fun. But of course, I love vegetables. So I found personally my favorite things to put on the grill were kind of like oversized vegetables that you could cut with a steak knife, especially for vegetarian food. We don't always get those kind of big pieces on the plate. It's a lot of smaller things or softer things. So things like grilled cauliflower steaks are great, large asparagus, spears. And I love throwing fruit on there too. Anything in season, summer, spring. Yeah.
Okay. So walk us through how to keep the vegetables, you know, hearty and larger so you can cut them apart, but also grill them enough that they are done and pleasant to eat. And it doesn't just feel like you've taken a giant chunk of cauliflower raw and set it on your plate, but it's also not mushy. Like there's a sweet spot in the middle there that I need to get to.
Yes, totally. So it's nice to have a good marinade for your vegetables. Ideally, like 15 or 30 minutes for marinating. It doesn't need to marinate all day or it might become too soggy. So we think strong flavors like citrus juices, orange juice, lemon juice, some olive oil, maybe some vinegar, garlic, anything that's really going to hold up to the high heat, anything delicate will kind of lose along the way. And then we just want to grill it till the marks are formed on the grill. Now, if it needs further cooking, if it's kind of like underdone in the center or starchy, you can always put it in the oven or let it sit covered either on a warmer spot on the grill or covered off the heat.
So that's an important point because grills are set up differently and there are different levels of heat that we can control, some that we can't. How should we set the grill up?
Yes, that's a great question. So grilling is one of the least consistent heat cooking methods, right? Ovens are pretty even, but grilling is more of an art. We need to know where the hot spots are, where the cooler spots are, where the wind is going to hit the food. So once you kind of have an idea of where the hotter spots on the grill are, you can set that as a space up for it to get its marks. And then your grill might have a higher rack that's less direct heat that you can use to cook more of the inside of the food rather than the outside of the food.
And what temperature should we try to start at so that we can try to get the specifically, I guess, vegetables right now done, you know, without charring them beyond recognition?
So I think the key here is timing. It's okay. Really hard to measure temperature on a grill, especially if it's open. So I would crank the heat up pretty high. And then if it feels like things are cooking too quickly, you can always do like a medium high heat. But we generally want to have it on a pretty high heat while we're grilling.
All right, we'll start there. Anne Ziada is a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York, and we're welcoming your calls. You can use 800-642-1234. Have you tried grilling fruits and vegetables before? Did it work? Share it with us or ask your question at 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And while we're on the vegetable track, you gave us a recipe for grilled vegetable kebabs. We have that posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. We don't have to go through all of the details or step by step, but what's the general idea to make this work?
Yes. So for this recipe, you could use a lot of different vegetables. But basically, we have a very strong marinade. So we have some vinegar, some crushed garlic, mustard, some oil. And then we want to cut our vegetables into even-sized pieces. So the recipe says to use portobello mushroom, zucchini, summer squash, and cherry tomatoes. But, you know, use whatever you have available will probably work pretty well. And these are designed where you're going to let the vegetables marinate in bite-sized pieces before putting them on a skewer. So if they're on a skewer, they're much easier to turn rather than have small pieces that might fall through the grates. And then once those are pretty quick cooking vegetables, so once they get their marks, you rotate them a couple times, and then they're ready to go.
What does it taste like?
Oh, it has a really nice kind of smoky, sweet flavor to it. And it has this fresh lightness that we want with summer food. Because grilling, the food doesn't always stay very hot after we take it off the heat. So it kind of has this weird cooling effect to have grilled food. It's smoky and charred, but it's not like a hot, heavy, you know, roast or a stew that's going to overheat us in the summer.
Yeah, and certainly you chose vegetables that would stay on the skewer, but you're also a big fan of grilling avocados?
Yes. Yeah. So the idea here is you really just kind of get a little bit of that heat, smoky flavor to it. So you can, you know, take an avocado halve, take the pit off. You can keep the skin on, put it face down on the grill for, you know, a couple minutes, then you can rotate it so it has a nice crosshatch. And then from there, you can use that as a garnish for maybe like a bowl-style dinner, or you can mash it up and make guacamole, put it on a sandwich, just to give it another little, you know, element to it.
And does that little bit of grilling really make a difference if you do still use it in guacamole where you're adding a lot of flavors in?
I think it does. And you can also kind of exaggerate it, too, by adding maybe some like chipotle or other ingredients that are kind of smoked or charred as well.
Gotcha. So you can pair it with that. That makes a lot of sense. We've got Brad in West Bend on the line ready to talk about grilling here. Hey, Brad.
How you doing?
Good. What are you thinking about?
I'm always thinking about Grillet, but I recently bought a book at the beginning of the season, and it had a little fun fact about figuring out the temp on your grill. If you take your hand, hold it flat, palm side down, about 6 inches above the grate. If anywhere between 0 and 5 seconds is the longest you can hold it, you're at about 450. 5 to 10, you're at about 400. 10 to 15, you're at about 350 degrees. Just a little fun fact for people who don't have, like, temperatures and stuff like that on their grills.
All right. Thanks, Brad. We appreciate that. Thanks for reading that tip and passing it along for us as we try to figure out how to handle grills, especially when it comes to different vegetables and fruits, as we're talking about it now. So, Brad, they're giving us a call at 800-642-1234. And now, Brad's trick would work for, you know, anything that you're grilling. Is there a special trick as we kind of leave some of the vegetables behind and talk about fruits? Do we have to think about the temperature or the setup of the grill differently?
As long as the grill is clean, I think that's a big part. Mm-hmm. If you had something that was savory and the grill's still dirty, you might kind of get that weird taste on the fruit. I mean, you should always keep your grill clean, but especially if you've been using it all day and you're going to switch over to dessert. But other than that, if your fruit is overripe, then you might want to put it on for a shorter period of time and just keep an eye on it, or maybe put it on a skewer if it's kind of soft. But grilling is nice maybe for fruits that are a little bit underripe, because they'll develop even more sugars as it cooks.
And when we're thinking about things to eat throughout the day, you mentioned salads, and you have this argument that we should try replacing our tomatoes with grilled peaches or apricots. Why do you do that?
Oh, yes. That was for a caprese salad. So if you're going to slice up some mozzarella in the summertime, I love tomatoes. You can't go wrong. But if you do want to switch it up, you can swap out the tomatoes for some grilled stone fruit. So that could be plums, apricots, nectarines. And then if you want to even swap the basil out, you can use mint. Works really well, too.
The fruits aren't too sweet in that. I mean, I love sweet foods, but I'm just trying to think about the tastes altogether.
If you feel like it's on the sweet side, you can balance it by using maybe like a balsamic or something a little more sour, or adding more fat to the dish or salt to the dish.
Good. So just keep making adjustments until you get it working the way it does for you.
Mm-hmm.
Great. This is Food Friday. We are talking about grilling, and we're focusing on things other than the usual burgers, brats, hot dogs. We're talking about grilling fruit and vegetables and other items that don't always take center stage when we think about grilling. Ann Ziada is our guest. She's a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York. You can join us at 800-642-1234. What question do you have about grilling vegetables or fruits, maybe even dessert or bread? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. The conversation continues here on Central Time. It's Food Friday. This week, we're talking about firing up the grill, but not for chicken or brats, other meats. We'll do that another time. Instead, we're focusing on things that we can cook over the flame, like corn and asparagus, other vegetables, or peaches and pineapple, or even things like bread, possibly dessert. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Voltina. Ann Ziada is our guest. She's a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York. And we're taking your tips for grilling vegetables or desserts at 800-642-1234. Let us know how you cook things, or ask your question at 800-642-1234. We've got Ashley in La Crosse ready to join the conversation. Good afternoon, Ashley.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Certainly. What are you thinking about when it comes to grilling?
A recent favorite grilling item for me has become grilling root veggies. Anything from beets and sweet potatoes to rutabaga, I find that they're all really delicious on the grill.
And Ashley, how does that change the taste of them, or does it really change the texture? What do you get out of putting them on the grill this way?
I really enjoy the smokiness and sort of that charred exterior to them. You know, it's got the same soft squishiness of roasting them, but it gets a little bit more smoky flavor to it, which is all what I'm interested in for sure.
Very cool. Thanks for sharing, Ashley. And Anne, are you a fan of those root vegetables too on the grill?
Sounds delicious. That sounds great.
Sign us up. That's perfect. Thanks again, Ashley, for calling 800-642-1234. You know, I've talked about this a couple of times, but we haven't quite gotten to it yet. We can grill bread. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, tell me more.
You can grill like unbaked bread, and you might want to close the oven for that part to create a little oven outside, because bread cooks at very high temperatures, you know, 450 and higher. Or you can do that as kind of like a secondary cooking method too. So maybe you have bread and you make crostinis and you toast your buns on the grill, for example. So you can fully cook the dough on the grill, or you can just use it to get some extra toasty flavor to it. But one easy one to do is like a flatbread or like a grilled pizza, because it's so thin, it cooks super quickly, and then you can just throw some toppings on it, have your cheese melt, and it's ready to go.
I just envision the crispiness. It sounds delicious.
Yes.
We've got Justin in Waukesha ready to talk grilling. Hey, Justin.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. What do you do?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was curious, because I've been told you can grill watermelon, but I've never tackled that task, and I've been curious how to do it properly.
All right, Justin. Thanks. Justin's waiting until Justin knows what to do to try his hand at that watermelon. And what are your tips for taking watermelon to the grill?
For watermelon, I would put it directly on the grill. You don't need to marinate it. You can keep it on the rind if that makes it easier for it to flip, because it will hold its shape a bit better. And then from there, once you have the grill marks on each side, you can take it off. You can dress it with a little lime juice or sea salt, or you can even use it to make like a grilled watermelon gazpacho, or, you know, take it from there.
And how should you prepare it ahead of time? I'm thinking about, would you cut it into smaller slices or leave it more in big steaks?
I think it depends on how you're going to eat it afterwards. So if you just want a nice wedge of it, the bigger pieces will always be easier to work with on the grill. So I would skip cutting them into smaller pieces, because then you have to put them on a skewer, unless you're ultimately going to serve them in those small sizes.
Okay, so just think it through, and then we can just adjust our cooking method and time, things like that, depending on the size of whatever we're cooking.
Yes, yeah.
Okay. We're talking with Ann Ziada, who's a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York. You can call 800-642-1234 if you'd like to join the conversation on grilling. We're talking about grilling lots of different things like vegetables and fruits, also about bread and some dessert. Heidi in Wheeler wants to talk with us. Hey, Heidi.
Hello. Just one thing I've been doing for years is grilling pound cakes. So then you can grill alongside any fruit you want. So I've even done strawberries real briefly on a skewer. Also, the comment on the watermelon, I'll usually skewer those two skewers in wedges, rind to rind, and you can flip them really easy that way, and they work out really well. So you got a serving of two, you know, right there, unless you...
Yeah. And Heidi, I appreciate that tip. I have one more question for you, though. Do you take pound cake that you've made or purchased and then slice it and put it on the grill and then combine everything later? Is that how it works?
Exactly. Exactly.
Gotcha. All right. Heidi, thanks so much. And we have another dessert question here with Christina in Glenwood City. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I'm wondering what kinds of desserts hold up to that smoky flavor that you get from a grill, and also... can you do cookies and fruit crisps?
Ooh, lots of good questions there, Christina. Thank you for the call. And Anne, we just heard Heidi talking about pound cake and putting that on. But Christina's wondering, what else can we do, especially because of the smoky flavor?
Yes, absolutely. So if you have a smoky flavor like that, you can kind of play with it. And it's kind of like a sweet and savory dessert. It's a little bit of a novelty. So you can kind of add like maybe a caramel sauce or other kind of things that have that toasted element to it to kind of marry it all together. And then for things like maybe like a fruit cobbler, you can always put like a cast iron pan on your grill and close it. So you could cook it on your grill. You won't get any char marks, but if you have the grill firing and you want to use it to cook something like a cobbler, you can definitely throw it on there.
And
I have to ask, because I feel like this might be something I try and then it might not work out totally. Are there ways to account for the mistakes if we overcook something, or can we take something off the grill and bring it into the oven? How do we handle the unknown there?
So if anything is ever undercooked on the inside and the outside is overcooked, then you can cover it so it prevents any extra browning on the surface. The steam will help cook it. And then you could put it in the oven at home, if that's safer, or you can cover it and keep it on the grill or keep it off the grill. If any pieces get a little bit charred, you might be able to trim them off. Or maybe you have a guest at your party who happens to love those charred pieces. Sometimes that person saves the day, and then you don't have to, you know, throw that piece away.
It's like the edges of the crispy cookies, which our caller also brought up. Are there things like should we try cookies on the grill? Is that something you've tried, Anne?
So I haven't tried cookies on an outdoor grill. I imagine if you were doing it, because sometimes here in the city, we'll use like cast iron grills on the stove, which don't have the open grate. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest taking a cold cookie dough, because then it won't melt too quickly and it will hold its shape while it gets that exterior cooking going. Once your outsides are done, for cookies, maybe smaller pieces or pieces that aren't too wide or thick. That way they cook evenly on the grill.
Excellent. What kind of encouragement can you give to those of us who might be a little bit skeptical that we can handle some of the things that we've talked about in this time?
I think go into it with a creative, open mind, and then you can always do test runs, right? So if you bake a batch of cookies, put one on the grill before putting all of them on the grill, right? That way, if it doesn't work out, if it's not working that day, you haven't wasted all your dough.
Sure, sure. And then you can do something else with the rest of it, and then it's not all gone and there's still dessert. What's one thing that you haven't mentioned or that I haven't brought up that you think, wow, this goes really well on the grill and people need to know about it?
So I like putting lettuces on the grill. It sounds like a little bit of a hippie thing to do, but things like cabbage, because I like using the grilling for that, like, part of the cooking process, right? So if you take cabbage wedges, you can even kind of massage them a little bit, throw them on the grill, and then slice them up and make a coleslaw out of that. Or, you know, make a kale salad out of kale that's been just lightly cooked on the grill.
Wow. And would you do that again, kind of like you were talking with the cauliflower steaks, or you said wedges work best?
Yeah, so the wedges just have a nice big shape that you can rotate on the grill. It's not going to evenly cook the whole cabbage, but if you slice it into a slaw or a salad, you can have it raw anyway. So we don't have to worry about it being undercooked.
Okay, so grilling fruits and vegetables, let go of the perfectionism, embrace the changes in the heat, cut stuff up and have fun.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And just stay present with it, because it's kind of an art. Whereas if you're baking, you put it in the oven, you kind of forget about it for at least 15 minutes. But with the grill, it really needs your full attention. So you can put some music on, just get comfortable standing there and enjoy it.
That's perfect. Anne, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Anne Ziada is a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York. We talked with her about what we can throw on the grill aside from the usual brats and burgers and hot dogs.